Hi, I'm Bill Maher, senior reporter for The Deal, where I cover the always colorful SPAC sector. On today's Drinks with The Deal, we welcome Josh Duclos, a private equity partner in the LA firm of Sidley Austin LP. Among his clients are those from the SPAC sector. Josh and I will talk about the SEC's new SPAC regulations, the larger market and economy, and where SPACs may be heading. Josh, thanks for being with us. Would you mind giving us a little background on your career and the focus of your practice?
Thanks, Bill. Pleasure to be with you. So as you mentioned, I'm in the M&A and private equity practice at Sidley Austin LLP. I sit here in beautiful sunny Los Angeles in Century City. And my career has predominantly focused on what you might think of at when you think of the West Coast, which is a lot of tech, high growth tech and life sciences companies, and specifically M&A. So when I first moved out to California, you know, almost 12 years ago now, I'd come from New York and London prior to that and was really looking to work with private equity and venture capital clients that were sponsoring tech companies and sort of getting in on the tech boom. And I've been really privileged to be able to do that over the last 12 or so years. And so my practice is really working a lot with venture and private equity backed companies, both as buyers and sellers in M&A transactions. And then obviously, apropos this conversation, that really includes a broad array of transactions outside strict M&A, including capital raising and through SPACs, going public transactions. I originally got involved in doing SPAC work, working with private equity clients looking to utilize the SPAC vehicle to take their companies public. And at that time, about 7 or 8 years ago, SPACs were a little of a niche market, a little more under the radar, special purpose vehicles indeed, and not really as mainstream. But really, around that time, talking 2017, 2018, you really started to see an uptick and you started to see different kinds of companies, and notably higher growth, earlier stage venture-backed companies start to look at these. You started to see sort of boards talk in meetings, not just about potential M&A opportunities or IPO, but also a potential SPAC opportunity. So started working with more of that private equity, venture capital-backed company client base, particularly in the tech and life sciences sector, doing these SPAC deals. And then obviously over the last few years, that really exploded in growth and now obviously moderating, but has really been an interesting experience. And as a practitioner, kind of a fun one, to be honest, really complicated transactions, trying to find unique and creative solutions to clients' problems, right? And it's always nice to be able to listen to clients' needs and concerns and problems and find available structures and creative solutions that fit the need and problem as opposed to the other way around. And I think one of the great things SPACs have offered and always have is another possible path to capital raising, to going public, but also just a possible path to really what is important for our clients as lawyers, which is executing on business plans, creating products that solve the needs of today and tomorrow. And being someone who's worked historically with tech and life sciences companies, it's all about the future. It's about where we're going, where we're progressing, and how to better our lives and create technology and products that enhance that. So, again, pleasure to be with you today and talk about that and SPACs generally.
Well, let's circle back a little bit to something you said a second ago. You've got a background in working with private equity firms. And what I have found to be interesting, and I'd certainly like to get your take on it, is that I think before SPACs exploded, private equity firms were among the leading users of SPACs from the standpoint of either being sponsors and wanting to be in on that side of it, or the other side of it, they would be speaking with SPACs about the possibility of grabbing up a portfolio company. I think it feels to me like the sponsor side of those transactions from a PE standpoint have slowed a little bit. And while PE firms are always mindful of their portfolio companies, it's been harder to track, I think, the business combinations across the broad market. I'm wondering what you've seen in terms of comfort from PE firms, whether they are still fans of the SPAC vehicle or whether they've backed away, maybe not so much because it's facts, but because of the marketplace.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's always hard to paint any of this with too broad a brush. I mean, obviously, look, just statistically, we had a explosion of SPACs in 2020, 2021, and participants in all sorts of industry, private equity, venture capital, all sorts of companies, every industry vertical, every geography, right? I think obviously that's come down and for a lot of reasons we'll probably discuss. I think at its core, though, you're right. A lot of the historical participants, sponsors, folks who would look at potentially utilizing the SPAC vehicle are, you know, they'll just what I would describe as sophisticated investors, which includes private equity, right? These are investors who think outside the box, who want to have a panoply of potential products and solutions to meet specific needs. And I think they were always, and I think still are, creative about potentially utilizing the SPAC structure, depending on the needs of the company at the time, particularly for portfolio companies. I think in terms of sponsoring SPACs, I mean, look, there are a lot of well-known private equity and private equity-like sponsors of SPACs. And I think some of them are still very much in the game and have SPACs out there. Some of them have backed off it a bit. You have to remember, too, we got to a point in the market where, you know, unusually, I think for SPACs historically, you had sponsors with multiple vehicles in the market at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that activity, you know, has clearly slowed and probably will remain that way, right? Where there's a little more deliberateness about how many vehicles you might have in the market at any given time and sort of timing the market in terms of raising one of these vehicles. But no, I wouldn't say about any group that they're sort of have taken themselves completely out of the market. I think everybody's opportunistic here. I think that's what you saw in the lead up to the big boom. And I think that's what you'll see. And whether it's fits and starts or it's, you know, a new normal of a plateaued number of more sustainable vehicles or who knows what, right? Depending on where the market, the broader economy take us. But I think you'll continue to see those types of investors be opportunistic and smart about whether they want to utilize the vehicle and when.
Okay. I know that much over the last few weeks has been made of the SEC finally getting around to adopting a package of regulations regarding SPACs that they've been seriously looking at and discussing for the past 2 years. And there's been a lot of talk about the fact that, boy, this is going to be a nail in the coffin of SPAC vehicles. I don't think that's true. I think SPACs are simply a vehicle that isn't for everybody to begin with. I don't think they're going away. But I am wondering whether you think there's been too much hype around the idea of the impact of the new rules since they've been in the ether essentially for the last couple of years. People had an idea of what would come and perhaps how they wished to deal with it. Am I reading too much into that, or has the hype been a little loud?
I think they're certainly important. I don't think you can diminish their impact. I will say that I think what dwarfs them in impact is really the market. I think what you saw slow down the SPAC market, which itself was probably overheated with the number of SPACs and number of participants. But I think the broader issues that slowed the SPAC market, I think, are the same ones that slowed the M&A market and the IPO market and what I'll just generally call sort of the capital markets and the transactional markets, you know, as a as a transactional attorney generally, which were a very different interest rate environment, right? Where suddenly you came off a period practically for my entire career thus far as a young attorney of, you know, zero to very low interest rates combined with stimulus, a lot of government stimulus, an era really of cheaper capital, frankly, that starting from the great financial crisis when I started my career to a year or 18 months ago, really created a ripe environment for high growth companies in particular. And think about things like, as I said, tech companies, life sciences companies, all the way from the kinds of companies we'd think of as moonshots to those we see every single day solving real everyday problems for us. A kind of environment where they could raise money and towards future growth, very attractive rates, both in the equity markets and the debt markets, right? And I think what you saw was very quickly post-pandemic, things changed. Inflation rose, interest rates rose, and that environment changed. And I think it happened, unfortunately, I think not just for newly public de-SPAC companies, but also for newly public companies that went through an IPO and for companies that are still private trying to raise capital. It happened at a time right after the boom, right, where everybody was sort of poised to continue to execute on growth plans that in many cases probably required that environment or some form of it to continue. And suddenly that sort of spigot of available capital shut off. And I'm being very broad. There's obviously a lot more detail and nuance to it. But I think if you look at that, the market generally, that's what has really slowed SPACs along with everything else. Now, obviously, on top of that, for SPACs, you have an incredible length and scope of new regulation, you know, layered on top of that. Now, to your point, these came out almost 2 years ago, right, as proposed rules. And a lot of people were up in arms about them at the time. But at the end of the day, they were worked through, right? People who participate in the transactions who thought, I don't want to participate in this sort of potential new rule environment, backed away from them. Those who wanted to continue, we worked with them as lawyers, as advisors, to digest these rules and see, are they practical? Can we digest them? Can we build them into our deals today as if they were real and law today? And I think that largely happened, right? And so certainly that changed the contours of certain types of deals and how many deals got done and how successful they were. But again, I think in a manner that was really dwarfed by the effects of the market. I think today, now that the rules have been finalized, I think it's a big deal. I wouldn't want to sort of act as if they don't matter, but I think just because of that lag time between when they were proposed and when they were implemented is somewhat of a collective shrug by the folks who practice in the industry. Now, obviously, I think I'm sure some would have hoped, you know, the rules got watered down a bit more and the SEC changed its path. But again, I don't think anybody saw when they came out that they're sort of out of the game and this really changed the status quo. I think the status quo adapted really first and foremost to the market and then secondarily to the rules as they were proposed a couple of years ago. And the product has evolved because of it.
I'm curious, and granted, I mean, I want to say the final rules were 572 pages long. But were there any changes that you looked at and you thought, yeah, you know what? This could have an impact on how we do things. For instance, the regulations where the SEC was going to insist investment bankers would be almost exactly as underwriters in traditional IPOs. That rule was not adopted. And that rule was, I think, to be fair, very much feared in the marketplace and caused a change of behavior immediately when a number of banks walked away from the SPAC product and just said, nah, you know what? We're uncomfortable right now. I don't know that they're going to necessarily come back. I think there are going to be investment banks who are always going to be in the SPAC space, but I don't know that the bulge brackets will be among them. You're in the capital markets every single day. What are you seeing or hearing around that particular regulation?
Yeah, there's certainly some of the potentially broader rules that the SEC proposed were narrowed. And some of those that you just referenced, in particular the underwriter definition, you know, definitely pulled back a bit in a manner that, at least on the face of the rules themselves, doesn't implement the kind of regulatory regime on potential transaction participants like banks in these deals that they potentially could have under the proposed rules. That being said, I think a lot of people also read the final rules to create, you know, some interpretation and uncertainty where it still sort of leaves the door open to that. And so I think to the extent there was reticence to be involved in deals for that reason alone, I don't think the final rules have really changed that. I do tend to think, though, that you can't really just look at that rule in a vacuum and say that that's a reason somebody would not want to be involved in the transaction. I think it's that, along with the types of deals that were getting done the last few years, which again were a lot of them involved really earlier stage high growth companies where valuation was very much dependent on future performance and therefore the use of projections to raise substantial amounts of money in a pipe transaction and also to potentially justify the SPAC board's valuation. And the rules themselves obviously have also not just added disclosure requirements with respect to those projections, which, by the way, apply to non-SPAC transactions as well. They apply broadly to the use of projections
That's right.
Registration statements and proxies. And so what the final rules have done is eliminate a safe harbor, as you know, under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, which is commonly used and relied upon in public company merger contexts where projections play a role in the obtaining of fairness opinions. And that's now eliminated that safe harbor for SPACs. So what it would mean is that that same company that might have said, you know, for whatever reason, we need to use 5 years of projections to get this deal over the line 2 years ago, both the company itself and potential advisors have to think about whether or not they can do that or want to do that and take the risk, given they no longer have a safe harbor, but could potentially be subject to lawsuits from investors looking at those projections if those projections don't come to fruition. And so, you know, it's not really just about, am I deemed an underwriter or do I have a safe harbor for use of these projections? But all of that together, I think, creates a different environment that might make, I think, some participants not back out of these transactions, but I think just rethink how they're done, rethink whether they need to use projections, rethink as a potential investment bank advising on a deal, what sort of protections or deliverables will I need from law firms and accountants and clients to get comfortable the same way I would in an IPO. And by the way, that's back to the point of what's already been digested. I think what we've seen in transactions for the last 18 months is that the advisors on these transactions are already operating that way. They're already asking for comfort letters from auditors and 10b5 opinions from lawyers. And so it's certainly
right.
The biggest practical effect I've seen, it's increased the cost of these transactions effectively, because those are, you know, greater sort of transaction costs and friction and things that now require lawyers and accountants to work a little harder on extra deliverables. But I think what I and a lot of practitioners would tell you, we don't think it actually changes the core of the transactions we've been seeing. You can always cherry pick that some transaction here or there, whether it's a de-SPAC or an IPO, was a bad one. But for those of us who, you know, practice in this field, we've always done diligence. You know, we've always kicked the can on projections and the use of projections and the need for them and made sure that the pencil is sharpened and they're well wrought. So I think good, healthy transaction participants have been operating this way. And a lot of these new rules just sort of create more guidelines and official sort of roadmaps towards how to operate within the parameters set by the SEC without really changing the core market practice. And that's why, again, go back to this idea that what's really changing the core market practice is the market itself and the broader economic environment rather than these SEC rules.
You bring up the safe harbor change, which I would think for some of the companies you've been working with or you've worked with in the past, younger companies, tech companies that haven't had a lot of history, but have what they believe to be a bright path in front of them, I would think it would make those companies either more creative as they pitched a deal or need to be perhaps more detailed and deliberate in terms of how they approached the deal. Because as you pointed out back in 2017, 18, 19, the companies that you were seeing by and large were more well established, were often family businesses where they wanted to transition out and they wanted to be able to sell. And a SPAC vehicle made sense for them. What we saw, especially with the increase of SPACs, was we saw younger, more exciting companies coming in and being looked at. And I also think we saw more retail investors who didn't necessarily understand SPACs as a vehicle. They understood $10 a share. And this is an exciting company with a story, much like a story stock. But I'm just wondering, with the tech companies you've worked with, whether it's going to be up to them to look at things in a maybe perhaps a more deliberate fashion in order to be able to communicate to investors clearly where they want to go and why it's a good idea.
Well, look, a lot of the benefit that people saw in the popularity of the SPAC vehicle over the past few years was that it could facilitate an alternative go public transaction and bring more and more earlier stage, which yes, potentially means in some cases riskier, but also higher reward companies out of the private sphere to public investors, be that retail or other public investors, right? I mean, the idea was over the past 10, 20 years, you've seen a lot of shrinking of the number of public companies and a lot of opportunities staying and taken private. And this would facilitate sort of a more open door towards going public than just the traditional IPO path. And generally speaking, right, that's a good thing, right? More companies able to access the capital markets, more investors able to decide if they want to be in on the earlier stage or ground floor of investments and potentially realize greater returns alongside what has been private investors for the last few years. And I think what you'll see now is some companies, I think inevitably, if they feel like the use of projections is curtailed, they might be too early stage. They might not be able to utilize that. And, you know, I reserve judgment. Some people think that's a good thing. Some think it's a bad thing. I think it's case by case, as all these transactions, depending on the company. Are they ready to be public? And do they have comparative performance history to what they're trying to do to sell that to the public? Or do they really need to rely on future performance? And if so, how much can they rely on it? How comfortable are they? Remember, there's nothing about the new rules or anything else in the market that prohibits a very early stage company from going public through a SPAC or otherwise. And in that process, utilizing projections, it's more about, you know, both from a litigation risk, but also just a practical risk of being a new public company and wanting to deliver and wanting to maintain a good stock price and meet your projections, right? That it's always a question. I think any company you ask would prefer to use fewer projections rather than more, just because of that market reality and not wanting to be beholden to something in the short term. So I think you'll see some companies that just decide. And again, I think a lot of this is due to the market and less about, we're talking about the rules and these projections because we're lawyers, but a lot of it is really due to the market, is the financing. There are investors interested right now in taking a bet on an earlier stage, sort of capital intensive company in an environment where there's still high interest rates, relatively high inflation. And, you know, it's not necessarily clear whether they'll be able to execute on that plan in the short term. Others will decide that they are willing to take that chance and they want to utilize this product or others to go public and access the public markets. So I don't think it's really just about, can I use these projections? Can I not use these projections? Do I have to be more deliberate or not? I think it's really case by case about the specific company, the industry vertical they're in, and certainly how many years of projections they need to use for sure. But I just really think it's going to be case by case based on the company in question and how much money they need to raise, how many years they need to execute on their plan. I think you'll probably for sure see fewer pre-EBITDA positive, pre-profitability companies go public. I think you saw a lot of that. And again, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think to a lot of people who really champion this product, they wanted to take those companies and make them available to the general investor. And even the SEC, right? It's not its interest or job to be opining on whether an investment is a good one or not. What they want to really make sure is that disclosure is rigorous, process is rigorous, and that the companies that are being taken to public investors are ones that are abiding by those standards so that investors are well-informed and can make those decisions. But in terms of whether or not a specific company will choose to access this path based on its development stage, I think inevitably you'll see a curtailment of those earlier stage companies until and unless I think the market improves first and foremost.
I want to just briefly touch on the SEC and then get away from the whole rules thing. I found the SEC's position to be interesting in that part of their charge is to make it easier to raise capital in a public market. And if a company chooses to go public themselves, one of the other charges they have is to protect investors. And I think where the SPACs were concerned, they found themselves at a crossroad. Because if they came down with very stringent rules, they were going to curtail the marketplace from the standpoint of people participating, companies deciding this is how they wanted to go, or this is the vehicle they wish to use. But at the same time, I think they had to protect investors from themselves. You're not talking about having to protect hedge funds. Hedge funds know what the hell they're doing. It's Joe Sixpack who found out about this space company that had a chance to be a tugboat in space to move things around. And that was pretty exciting. And nobody was doing that. And it was only $10 a share. Well, yeah, except for that particular company was essentially a fraud. And the investor had no way of kind of getting at it. So I thought the SEC was kind of put in a hard position where SPACs were concerned with this particular market, and maybe too much was made of it. On the other hand, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, look, I think the instances that I'm aware of that I've seen of actual fraud, I think are few and far between, right? And I think, unfortunately, as with any market or product, it's those that sort of get the headlines and everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's an important point. I think, you know, we've talked in the past, what's going to change the market, if anything? It's going to be more better deals that have healthier performance, right? But I think in terms of like those few we can point to where it was, you know, there's some litigation or regulatory action that has shown some sort of malfeasance. I think it's a very small number. And I think obviously, look, is the SEC concerned with that? Yes. Is my concern with that as a lawyer? Absolutely. I think their broader concern, though, was less about filtering out like absolute fraud, which can happen in any context, and more about, you know, I think of the old saying, haste makes waste, right? Things were moving at a very, very fast pace at a very high volume that outstripped anything we'd seen before, not just in terms of SPACs, but in terms of IPOs generally and companies getting public through the vehicle. And I think there was concern, as with anything, that maybe market practice was getting ahead of the old rules and regulations and how people thought about the way companies go public and merge with a SPAC. And the, you know, the SEC, I think rightfully, you know, devoted resources and took a look at that. You can have varying opinions about where they came out on the rules themselves and the scope and breadth, but I think certainly their interest is protecting investors, but I don't think it's protecting investors from themselves, right? I think it presumes that every investor wants to be informed and is going to utilize the information that's there in front of them. That's trying to create not just a regulatory scheme, but sort of a market in terms of market participants, financing, lawyers, bankers, sort of the so-called gatekeepers, a market that functions in a manner that is deliberate, that has fulsome disclosure, and has various checks and balances to ensure that when the company does get ready to that point and is going public via SPAC, or a traditional IPO, it's gone through both an internal process and now an external disclosure process that ensures rigorous and well-wrought disclosure of the facts of the company. And I think, again, my personal opinion is, I think by and large, the vast majority of deals already operated that way.
Mm-hmm.
And these rules are sort of putting in formal sort of statutory language, what was by and large already market practice. Does that mean that there weren't people on the fringes who maybe weren't abiding by, you know, these sort of rules in spirit? Absolutely. But I still continue to think, you know, those are on the fringes. I think if you look at poor performance in any of these newly public companies, it has a lot more to do with the market itself and sort of investor appetite than it does with any specific rule that was put in place or lack thereof.
Okay. Let's take a look at the M&A market from kind of a 30,000 foot spot and then zero down a bit. You are in M&A every single day, whether it's SPACs or more traditional M&A. I'm wondering, from where you sit looking at the marketplace now, what are the elements that are shaping the market we're in currently?
Yeah, I mean, look, the majority of my life has been spent doing regular M&A, quote unquote, right? As partner of mine likes to say, you know, I'm moonlighting in SPACs the last few years. I think, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the pressures we see in the ability to get these SPAC deals over the line, it's really sort of an accentuated version of what we've seen in the broader market the last 12 or 18 months. I think it's just been a very uncertain time. The, you know, again, between inflation, interest rates, and there's this disconnect, right, between what you see when you look at, you know, you put on at CNBC and see stock market performance, everything's up, right? I mean, we're at record highs. But I think when you actually look at transactions, as someone who devotes their life to doing transactions, particularly in the private equity and venture capital space, there's still a lot of uncertainty about not just global geopolitical issues, but the sort of interest rate and credit environment and when things will sort of normalize or change. And I think, you know, that's put pressure on M&A transactions generally, right? There is a you know, you came off a period of very high valuations where now if you're a company who wants to sell yourself, you're thinking, well, why isn't my company worth what I thought it, you know, what I was told it was worth 2 years ago? At the same time, as a buyer, obviously, you want to ensure that sort of, if you can, the valuations have bottomed out and you're buying at a good time and not overpaying. Also, for those who rely on leverage, on getting debt to do these acquisitions, you really want to make sure you're able to access the debt markets efficiently and make the math work on these transactions. So I think everybody thinks this stuff is normalizing and we're getting to a point where there's going to be more meeting of the minds on transactions and more participation. But I think just as you've seen a slowdown in the SPAC market, you've seen sort of comparatively, right? Things are still very busy. I mean, if you look at the statistics last year, again, there was this weird disconnect between sentiment and reality, where just like consumers have this sentiment right now that the economy is bad, it turns out the economy is pretty good and the stock market's doing well. And you talk to sort of bankers and lawyers, and there's this sentiment that deal making is down, and it is from 10-year highs, but it's still pretty healthy, right? And I think when you take that into account and take into account the fact that comparatively, all these transaction participants are sort of waiting and hungry to get in and sell companies and buy companies and take companies public and do deals, I think there is a growing sense of optimism and hope that the markets are going to open back up on these transactions pretty quickly. And I think when that happens, what will happen with SPACs? I don't know, right? I don't think, just being conservative, we're going to get back to a point where it's all out craziness and you're seeing nearly the number of de-SPAC transactions. I think these vehicles will be utilized a little more sparingly, but I do think they'll continue to be utilized again, particularly for transaction participants that are looking at them for very specific purposes, for very sort of purpose-built use for certain companies. But I do think, you know, generally, as you and I have talked about in the past, you can kind of look at what's going on in the SPAC market as a kind of magnified microcosm of what's going on in the broader market, which is just less access to efficient equity and debt capital right now, as well as sort of pressures, notably inflationary pressures on, you know, company performance, particularly high growth, smaller, earlier stage companies. And some of that's got to give, I think, until you get to the point where you're going to see an uptick in activity.
Well, I think you hit on an important thing, although you didn't label it as such. There is the perception and there's the reality. And just grabbing up some data from our friends at PrivateRaise, in 2021, which was a boom year, the largest year for SPACs, 199 business combinations closed. Now, that's attributable to a certain extent over the number of SPACs that were out there and hunting for deals. But the following year, when 2022, when people said, well, you know, things have begun to slow down and we're beginning to make some sense, perhaps. Yeah, 102 deals closed. And last year, when people said, well, you know, the market is pretty dead, this is a pretty hard place right now, you had 99. Three less deals for the entire year in a what was considered to be a pretty down year. So I do think there is the difference between the reality and how it feels, maybe. The other thing is, too, I think people at large look at the economy, the place they live, and they go to the grocery store and a jar of peanut butter is $9. And they go, wow. That's insane.
Bill, you're buying some fancy peanut butter.
No. And clearly it was organic. It was shade grown. But the thing of it is it's the experience they're bringing. Or they put their house on the market and they're suddenly, instead of having 17 people at the door, they've got 6 people at the door. We draw the perception from that. Whereas the price of the house year over year might be up, actually, the sales price you can receive, but it is how we see things sometimes.
Yeah, you also have to remember what, you know, we're talking about transactions here, right? And we're not just talking about how our listed big, you know, multinational corporations doing. You know, corporations are doing well, corporate profits are up, the stock market's up. But I think on a transactional basis, and particularly again, when you look at high growth companies, right? Let's call, you know, look at the tech industry. There's no question. If you look at the number of deals getting done, more of them are down rounds, right? When you look at sort of venture capital financings, far fewer private equity deals in the last couple of years than there were in the preceding 8-9 years. That, to me, that's not something that's going to last a long time. This isn't some complete sectoral change where suddenly we're not going to see deal making anymore. Nothing's changed about the reality of our lives, right? Where the products these companies are making are still necessary. And, you know, the future is coming at us super fast. And, you know, everybody's talking about AI and in the space, right? I mean, all of this stuff is still happening. So the underlying need, the thing driving the need for a lot of these companies is still there. The question is just when and how will they be able to access sort of the capital on a transactional basis to be able to achieve their goals. And maybe it means some of the goals are achievable, but on a longer timeline, right? Or maybe it means, you know, we wait until markets open back up and things get super busy again. I think no matter what, at the end of the day, we're going to see these companies, the best ones are going to survive. They're going to get financed. They're going to get bought and sold. And hopefully those like me will be able to help people get that done. But I think you're right. I think a lot of it is perception, and particularly when you come off really kind of unusually heightened periods where you have these short bursts of activity. If you come off 2021, where, you know, it's just a dizzying number of deals, and then suddenly in 2024, it seems like a normal number of deals, comparatively, it seems like you're way down, whereas really, you know, you're sort of back to a normal. And I think the next year will really be telling, right? I think everybody's a prognosticator and says, well, you know, will the markets really open back up for M&A in late 24? Will it be 25? Who knows? You know, you see a bunch of big deals get done, and then suddenly the news headline read that, you know, the market's back open right now and earlier than people thought. I think we'll just have to continue to wait and see.
You've worked with a lot of technology companies, and there has been over the long haul something of a distrust, I think, between technology companies and Wall Street, in that tech companies didn't necessarily feel like they were well understood by the guys on Wall Street. And guys on Wall Street tend to feel like they're pretty smart folks and that they've got some things figured out, and that the guys in Silicon Valley, hey, they're playing ping pong and they're coming up with ideas that maybe nobody necessarily needs today. There were a lot of technology companies that got involved with SPACs, and some of the deals didn't turn out. Has that contributed at all? Because I think, though I don't think of SPACs as being necessarily a huge Wall Street instrument, they were certainly grasped in a huge bear hug by Wall Street when there was business. Are technology companies impacted at all by SPAC deals that didn't go well for tech companies, or are they open to all possibility?
I think they're still open to all possibilities, right? Again, I think you'll see fewer of those deals get done for sure. Just like right now we're seeing in this moment in time, we're seeing fewer of these companies go public through a traditional IPO. But I think as with any cycle, that will change and you'll see that window open back up in earnest. And it'll be interesting, Frank. I don't know the answer. It'll be interesting to see when that opens up and there's more tech IPOs. Are there more tech de-SPACs? I anticipate there probably will be, but to what level and relative proportion? I don't know. I do think at the end of the day, look, there's different investments for different profiles of investor, right? And how much risk they're interested in taking and how much reward they're potentially looking for. And there's no question. I mean, earlier stage, high growth tech companies, they're exactly what they sound like, high growth. And that means necessarily less history of performance, less proven stability, but more potential upside. And I think, are we going to ever reach this perfect efficient point where exactly the right companies with exactly the right kind of risk are the ones going public and exactly the right companies that are too risky are staying private? And is that even the prescriptive world we need to live in or supposed to live in? I don't know. I think you're constantly going to have this give and take there with the fact that companies want to go public. They want an exit. It's a big event. They also want not just for itself, but to have access to greater forms of capital, right? I mean, that's really what this is about. And a lot of the reasons you saw that certain tech companies went public through a SPAC during the boom instead of an M&A transaction is they wanted to maintain control as well. They thought there was future growth and future upside and profitability, and they didn't want to just sell. They wanted to go public, and this was sort of a way for them to do it, particularly when there was a lot of financing available, a way for them to raise money, execute on their plan, maintain control, sort of the best of all worlds, right? And I think you still have this dynamic with tech companies where if they're earlier stage, even later stage, you know, they have founders and employees and investors who really want to continue to grow the company. They're not ready to exit. And traditionally, if you got to that point where you wanted to continue to grow, but you were mature enough to access the public markets, you know, you went public and that's what you did. And I think we're still going to see that. And the question is, what is that right level in terms of maturity, track record, growth profile? There are big tech companies today who are doing tremendously well in the stock market and have investors talk about them every day, and they're still not where they're aiming to be in terms of profitability. So I don't think there's a right or wrong there. So I probably didn't answer your question, Bill, but I don't think there is some sort of negative halo overhang here for tech generally. I think certainly there is for the SPAC product, and it remains to be seen how long that will take to come off. But I do think all it takes is good deals, right? The more you see good deals and consistent performance and people hitting those projections and products that work, then I think you'll see people utilize the product more. But I think, you know, tech is still going to be an important, probably the most important tech in life sciences to solve our problems as people in 2024 and beyond, right? So I certainly don't think there's some end to tech that's spelled with sort of certain bad performance by certain companies that went public through a SPAC.
All right. Let's take a chance here and kind of a final SPAC question. We're approaching a period of time where there are a lot of SPACs that are running out of timeline. They are approaching either their internal deadline of maybe 24 months, or they're approaching the deadline imposed by the exchanges of 3 years, or you've got to delist or liquidate. I'm wondering what you think we're going to see over the course of maybe the next year. I know there's a lot of pressure for some SPACs out there to get something done or to liquidate because they're simply running out of road. But I'm also thinking that we're going to see deals that are probably smaller in size because we still have a difficult capital market. And I think SPACs that have not raised a huge amount of money may be more nimble in a challenging market. And so I'm just wondering what you see going from maybe here to the end of the year in the marketplace.
I think the biggest hurdle right now in all transactions is financing. And so if you look at these SPACs that are in the pipeline trying to get done, it's not the SEC rules, it's access to financing. And so I think what I'm seeing is companies that don't need as much financing to have other reasons to want to get public and be public when the markets turn so they can access the capital markets. I think they're still very interested in the product. I think there's a lot of foreign companies that sit outside the United States really want to be listed in the United States to access the U.S. capital markets. I think so. We're seeing a lot of cross-border transactions with non-U.S. entities. As you mentioned, I think one big result of the downturn has been smaller deals. So companies don't need to be worth multiple billions of dollars and do a deal with a SPAC that has hundreds of millions of dollars in trust. So you'll see smaller deals. What that also means is mid-cap, small-cap, even micro-cap companies going public, which, again, I mean, some people think is a very good thing, right? Why does every public company need to be large-cap? And some people think, you know, what we'd like to see is a more diversified market with large cap, mid cap, small cap, give people the options to invest differently, diversify their risk profile. So I think you'll see that. I think geographical diversity, size diversity, but for certain, I think outside of deals where you have insiders or sponsor money, where they really want to put a lot of more money to work, I think you'll see deals and are seeing deals where financing is less of prerequisite or at least massive mega deal financing, which means also companies that are probably generating cash, right? And can sort of wait out the storm until the profile for them to be able to raise money changes. And we talked to a lot of clients who, as I said, they really want to utilize the product, get public. They don't need a lot of cash today. They're in it for the long term. They're not super sensitive to the vicissitudes of their stock price in the short term. They're really thinking long-term execution on a business plan they have and the desire to be on the public market so that when they have the opportunity, they can utilize that to raise the financing they need and provide liquidity to their investors.
We've talked about what keeps you busy and the types of deals you've been involved with and types of sectors that are doing business. Let's talk about how you spend some time when you're not doing billable hours. What kind of hobbies do you have?
Well, I'm an M&A attorney, Bill, so there is no time when I'm not working on billable hours. You know, occasionally when I find those scraps of time, well, I love to be with my fabulous family, my wonderful wife, and my one-year-old daughter, who pretty much takes up all my time and interest right now, really. So whatever hobbies or interests I had before outside of the law are now all devoted to my daughter, really. But I love to hike. I love the great outdoors and nature whenever I get a chance. Being in California, I'm a transplant to California. I grew up in Rhode Island, and I love being in a place where there's mountains and beaches and deserts and, you know, so much world to explore. So that tends to be where I spend a lot of my time.
I'd like to thank Josh for being generous with his time and his insights. Thank you very much, sir.
Pleasure as always.
I'm Bill Maher. Until next time.